I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today. But holy fuck, I'm back again. Just like the phoenix from the flames. Oh, Jesus Christ, oh, what's his name? I was lost, but now I'm found.
Save you all from your damnation. Start the fucking celebration. Seen the holy light. Everybody bow before me. Gather round and all adore me. Restore me to my former glory. The resurrection's night.
Nick Helm is a man so rock and roll, the discipline is not even big enough for him. A fine musician, in fact his latest album is imminent, he's made his name as a comedian and actor, providing heavy entertainment to the masses. His star has shone brightest in hit comedy Uncle, in which he plays a layabout musician trying to make it big. Ahead of his all-killer Sun Filler live show in London, I thought I'd quiz him on the music he couldn't live without.
Well, Nick, it's an absolute pleasure to have you as a guest on Desert Isolation Discs.
Thank you for having me.
We're recording in the Pleasance Theatre, your local, in fact.
Yes, this is my local, yes. I live around the corner.
Yeah. It's a man with a huge red nose straight behind you that I'll try not to be...
I think that's Mark Watson.
Is it?
I've got a feeling.
It's definitely got his glasses and beard.
I think somebody must have done it during one of his 24-hour shows.
Ah, that would make sense. Does he love Gary Lineker, as the speech bubble says?
I don't know, because I might be totally wrong. But I think, yeah, there you go. Good luck, Mark.
Ah, that would make sense.
We're going for a world-hugging record. I mean, it's a bit twee.
And it is... like 15 foot long.
Yeah, I think they must have got someone in to do it. I doubt it would have taken them 24 hours though, so job's worth.
So how did you approach picking your favourite tunes?
Well, do you want the true story? The real story is my PR lady told me I had to come up with three, and it took me ages to come up with three, and I was I deliberated over it for a long time, and then 2 minutes ago you said you wanted eight, and I've just like pulled another five out my arse, and it'll change like immediately. As soon as I've said it, I'll regret it. I mean, I already regret some of the stuff on the list as it is.
It's like I handed you, I was Dale Winton on Supermarket Sweep, I handed you a basket,
yeah.
And then just as you were about to set off, I said, oh, actually, you can have a trolley, and you just piled them
and
in.
There we go, perfect timing as well.
The sound of something being piled in. So Nick, tell us about the first one then.
Well, one of my favourite composers is Ennio Morricone. I went to see him with my friend... I went to see him with my friend Nathaniel, and when we got there, we were both kind of really excited about it. And we, the one thing that we were saying was, do you think it'll play the theme tune from Untouchables?
Yeah.
And we were really excited about it. We were just like thinking, obviously he's going to play Ecstasy of Gold, but do you think he'll play the Untouchables theme tune?
Yeah.
And not only did he play it, but he opened with it. Mm. And I think that is one of the best. From Brian De Palma's Untouchables, it's like one of the best opening credit sequences. Mm. And the theme tune is really sort of like unnerving, and it's got a really kind of like it's very very rhythmic. Mm. But it's kind of like it's just that it's relentless kind of like beat to it, and when you're watching it, it really gets you kind of like in the mood to watch a film. But it really sets the tone for the film like amazingly.
Because you are a massive film buff, aren't you?
I am a massive, massive film buff. And actually, I've just realised I've got a couple of. Oh wow, I've got three Kevin Costner films on here without even trying.
This should be a listen along. This could be a DVD extra for Costner.
That's crazy. That is really crazy though. I've just literally realised I've got three Kevin Costner films. So I'm going with Untouchables for my first one because I think it's a good way to start anything off. But
great.
Yeah, amazing song.
Let's give it a listen. Great, the fantastic Ennio Morricone in it. So tell us, we all know your comedy work and your music work and your acting. Mm. What's your attitude to music within that? As in, do you have a preference within those three incredibly
What's my favourite? What's my favourite
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, what do you enjoy doing the most? You know,
I think that what I've tried really hard to do is to not pigeonhole myself and not typecast myself, and I just like being creative, really. And what I found was, when I was at school, I used to be in a band, and I used to write theatre, and I used to do, like, you know, write school assemblies and stuff like that, and be in all of the plays, and you know, and then when I got older, I started writing poetry, and I was always used to like doing art, and so I used to do all of that stuff. And then when I started doing stand up, and I started doing Edinburgh, I realised that, you know, you ended up like, you know, you were writing and directing. I started off doing plays in Edinburgh, but they were comedies, so you'd write and direct your own comedy.
Yeah,
you'd design the sets and the costumes and the posters, and so that sort of like it would just tick a lot of artistic boxes, and I think, and then when I started doing stand up, I only had 15 minutes of material. I had to do 20, and so I just whacked in one of my songs. And what I found was, the more sincere I was with my songs, I used to write quite heartfelt, sincere songs.
Yeah.
And what I found is that when you did it, people laughed at them. so you just sort of like go, yeah, it's meant to be, it's meant to be funny. Yeah, you're meant to, no, it's not my heartbreaking, really, you know. No.
So that was just a happy accident.
It was a happy, and then I think that's sort of like where I sort of developed my sense of humour from, which was, I found that the more sincere and honest you were, or the more, like, awkward you made things, the funnier it got, really. And because people's mechanism would be like, I can't handle this, it's too embarrassing, so I'm going to laugh.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like how my act developed. But I don't really, I've started making films as well, so I don't really have a preference to what I do. It's just, when you feel like one of the things that you're doing is getting a bit stale, you can always move on to the next thing.
Do you think people understand that it is an act?
Not always. I don't think they do always. I don't think they have to. No. I think that sometimes when people don't understand that it's an act, the people that do understand it's an act enjoy it more.
Mm.
So, because I split audiences, you know. Yeah. So I'll have a good gig and a bad gig.
Yeah.
At the same time, so there'll be audiences that love it and audiences that hate it.
Yeah.
And when the audiences that hate it, when the audiences that love it notice the audience that hate it, then they love it more. There was a gig I did in Edinburgh in 2011, and I got a 5-star review from the Telegraph. And that meant that all of these Telegraph readers came to see this 5-star show that didn't exist. It didn't exist. It was just like one guy liked it, he gave it 5 stars.
Yeah.
And all the Telegraph readers went, oh, it's 5 stars, it must be excellent. And so they came in with their arms folded and they were like, where's this 5-star show? And you go, well, really, it's a group effort. You know, if the audience like it and you like it, and you're enjoying it, then it becomes a 5-star show. But if the audience hate it, and you hate being on stage, then it's, you know, it's going to fail. So it's a day by day. It's a moment. It's like, you know, bottling lightning. You know?
Yeah. No, that's such a good point. The audience don't.
It's almost impossible, I think, to review live comedy unless it's a recording of it. You know.
Yeah.
which doesn't change. But if it's live comedy, you know, a show will change from day to day.
Mm.
And so I had all this audience in, and then and literally the front row, it was four rows deep.
Yeah.
It was at the Pleasance Beside, and the entire front row got up and left throughout the hour. Some people left within the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Which was ridiculous because they hadn't even had a chance to. But it was a very intense show, and some people couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Which was ridiculous because it's not my intention to do that.
No,
it's just to entertain people. And then the entire front row left, and some others. But the people that stayed, they thought it was amazing. Because they loved it even more. Because they were just like, I can't believe that people have reacted so strongly to this. And that's probably one of my favourite ever gigs. Because it involved a third of the audience walking out, you know? Which to most people would be a failure. But for me, it was just kind of like, no.
Good.
No, it's fine. It's better than everybody staying and mildly enjoying it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
definitely. Yeah. So, what was the second choice you've got?
Okay. So, my second one is going to be "The Power of Love" by Huey Lewis and the News from Back to the Future.
Fantastic.
And what I'd say about that is, it's just one of the best films ever made. And it's had a revival recently because of the year being. It was 2015 last year.
Yeah.
And that's good. It's justifiable. You know, people have gone. But I think that it's just one of those films that, I mean, that really is like lightning in a bottle. And I just really love that first film. I love Michael J. Fox. I love Christopher Lloyd and Lee. Is it Leah Thompson or Leah?
Leah,
is it? Yeah. Is it Leah or Lee? I never know because I've only seen it written down. But
yeah,
do you know what I mean?
I thought it was Liam.
I love her, and you know, she was like one of my like first screen crushes. And that song is just such an amazing. It's such a cool song, and it makes you feel like, because when it kicks in at the beginning of the film, it makes you feel like you're just about to go on like this adventure with it. It's such an amazing setup for the rest of the film. It's brilliant, and the whole soundtrack is great, but that song is brilliant.
Well, let's strap ourselves into the DeLorean then and motor on through. You mentioned Edinburgh there. How do you go about constructing a show for Edinburgh? You're not doing it this year, are you? But you've done it many, many, many times. Do you have a certain sort of tactic that you go out to theme it around something in particular? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of gutted that I'm not doing Edinburgh this year because I've got a show that I'd like to do, which for me was quite an important show because it was a very personal show that has a sell-by date, really.
Right.
Where I wrote it last year. I had a bit of a weird year last year, and so I wrote a show about it. But
what's the sort of broad theme?
Oh, it was just about... I moved into a flat and I was living by myself, and it was kind of about... And so I think every other year I've written in character, and this year was kind of like a fairly honest. I wasn't really. It wasn't really a character thing, and also I wasn't. It was one of the first shows that I've written in a long time where I wasn't particularly concerned about being funny.
Mm.
Where I think if I look at something like One Man Megamyth, which I did in 2013, that was all about putting on a show and let's entertain the audience.
What a show.
I had an Evel Knievel costume.
Yeah.
And I already had a title, One Man Megamyth. And then I basically based it around a title and a costume. And I said, right, I'll do it like an Evel Knievel show and we'll do the set. We'll be like a Hot Wheels set, like the old Evel Knievel stunt set. And then I wanted to write all of this material about Evel Knievel. And then this a cat, there was a stray cat that died in my garden. that I'd become very fond of. I hate cats, and I'd become very fond of this thing, and it actually like broke my heart a little bit. So I wrote my show all about all of the stuff. It's the first time I'd done it. It's the first time I'd done something that personal, where I'd written a show about all the stuff that had happened to me that year, and then I tied it all into the pointless pursuit of fame, and how we all die alone, and you know, the point of life is to make as many friends as possible. And then and the point was, you know, I hate cats, and my only friend was this cat, and then it died.
Yeah.
And so then I kick him over these little buses and stuff. And I thought that was a really well constructed show. I was really proud of that show.
Yeah.
And then but that's the thing. And then but they all have a certain rule. You know, you open with a song, you close with a sort of like a big cathartic number.
Yeah.
You open big, close big. Yeah. And in between, you have sort of like a roller coaster journey where you bring people right down and then you bring them up again at the end. And it's kind of like they've all got that similar structure. And then you just pick a different theme every year and kind of like explore that theme as much as you can.
What's your next tune?
My next tune is the theme tune from Commando by James Horner. Commando is... I was considering it as a guilty pleasure, but I'm not ashamed.
Yeah.
Commando is maybe my third favourite Arnold Schwarzenegger film, and I love Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I love Commando so much. I really love the Commando theme tune. It's up there with, I think Predator is also a good one, but I like the Commando one. I think what's interesting about the Commando one is it's almost identical to James Horner's 48 Hours score.
Yeah.
But it's almost identical, which is almost, it's gobsmacking.
Yeah.
How similar they are.
Yeah.
But it's all got all the same instruments, it's got all the same like moments, it's just a slightly different tune. But I grew up watching Commando, and I love it.
So you grew up watching Commando.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about your childhood? You grew up here in London, then went out to St Albans.
That's right. Yeah. That's well researched, yes. I grew up in...
Well, in my research, you've told me something I didn't know before, which is that market days in St Albans are Wednesdays and Saturdays.
Wednesdays and Saturdays, yes. If you've ever been chained around St Albans, you'll see the market, see the clock tower... You'll see the Waffle House, the Cathedral, and that's it. That's it. That's what we've got. That's what we've got in.
So, what was the young you like then?
I think the young me. What was the young me? I was very happy in London, and I was very unhappy in St Albans, and I never really fit into St Albans until probably about halfway through secondary school, where I kind of like started doing drama and got into that a bit, and I started writing stuff. And that was, it was kind of. But I think that's where I suddenly. I think that's why I developed a love of comedy.
Which comedians were you?
Well, we used to have video shops.
Yeah.
So, do you know what I mean? It was just kind of like on Friday night, your mum would take you to the video shop, and you'd get a Chinese takeaway, and then you'd watch. You'd spend like an hour in the video shop picking what you were going to watch over the weekend, and we'd always get like either like I think we used to watch Spaceballs a lot and Three Amigos, and so Steve Martin was like my hero. And I think that, so when I was growing up, my dad used to show me Woody Allen films. And I was really young. I was too young for them.
to bleed neurosis into a show.
Yeah. But like the thing is, it's really weird because like my dad used to find Woody Allen hilarious. He used to just like laugh and laugh and laugh at him, and I would be like this kid, and I didn't understand. I was like 4 or 5, and I didn't understand any of the jokes, but I'd look up at my dad and he was laughing, and I'd kind of like go, ha 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 ha, yeah, ha 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 ha, yeah, dad, yeah, ha ha. And then, and like Ghostbusters, obviously, but back then, Ghostbusters wasn't a comedy, it was a horror film. You know, you were tiny and you were like watching Ghostbusters, and my dad was laughing. You go, what are you laughing about, dad? That librarian ghost is terrifying. Do you know what I mean? What are you laughing about, dad? There's that ghost in the taxi is just, oh.
You were petrified.
Yeah, petrified. It was just, you went to the video shop every Friday, and because that's the difference in Netflix, isn't it? Because I was trying to find something to watch on Netflix yesterday. Yeah. You end up not watching anything.
Yeah.
Whereas if you were at the video shop, you'd get out, you know, when we were at university, I think we ended up getting out Idle Hands and A Clockwork Orgy, right? And there was like four or five of us. There was me, my girlfriend, and like 3 others.
Yeah.
And we'd go to Blockbuster and we'd get out and we were all nerds.
Yeah.
And we'd get out these films and you'd be stuck with them. And you'd sit down and you'd go, right, we've paid $1.99 to watch A Clockwork Orgy, we're going to do it.
So you'd get your 199 pence out of that.
Yeah. And I mean, that was really bad. It was really bad. But.
So what's the next song you've got for us?
So the next, I'll pick a song. This is Big Gun by AC/DC.
Great.
And it's from Last Action Hero. And I think it was probably my introduction to AC/DC.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the song so much. I think it's brilliant. And I use it quite often as get-in music. When the audience are coming in, I always use Big Gun as one of my favourite AC/DC tracks. AC/DC are one of my favourite bands. And I got there through Last Action Hero. The overlooked Arnold Schwarzenegger classic.
Overall, Arnie. So, can you give us an insight into the world of Uncle, then, the sitcom that you star in? You're absolutely fantastic, and it is a great show.
I'm all right.
How did that come about, and what's it like to film?
Well, that came about because in 2011, when I was doing my show Dare to Dream, that got nominated, and a lot of people suddenly started coming to see that. And Henry Normal from Baby Cow, he came to see it because I had a lot of Steve Coogan DVDs.
Yeah,
and knew
that's
who
his
he
production
was.
Company.
He's one of my Henry Normal is one of my heroes. And I came out and he was sat on the front row and it was like, oh, fuck it.
Did you manage to keep things together?
Barely. It was just like, thanks, Henry. I think they got this script, and I think the script had been around for a couple of years. And it had gone around a few other production companies. And it was exactly the same as the pilot, except he was an actor and not a musician.
Right.
And then I read it and I went in for a meeting to meet the writer, Oliver Refson, who directed it as well.
Yeah.
And they said, do you two like each other? And I was like, yeah. He goes, do you like the script? I was like, yeah. And he goes, all right, we'll film in the autumn. And that was it. I didn't audition or anything.
Wow.
And I'm terrible at audition, so it's just as well, because if I'd have auditioned for Uncle, I wouldn't have been an Uncle.
Yeah.
We did the pilot with Channel 4, and then Channel 4 didn't want it. And Shane, at that point, had left Channel 4 and went up to BBC Three. It was in the skip. Mm. So Shane just took it out of the skip and took it over to BBC Three. And, and I'm really amazingly grateful for that, because my life has changed several times because of various things. Like Russell Howard changed my life. And Keep Hold of the Gold changed my life as a live show. Then Russell Howard, and then doing Uncle changed my life. And it's kind of, I'm really grateful for all of that.
And so much of the show relies on the relationship between your character, Andy, and Rolly. How have you developed that relationship off screen?
Well, we don't hang out.
Do you wish he hung out and played computer games?
I really love him. I think he's brilliant. I don't have enough nice things to say about him, really. Mm. He's absolutely great. All my favourite scenes are the scenes where it's me and him on a park bench, or me and him like driving around in the car together. And we hardly ever see the kid because he has to do tutoring in between takes and stuff. So he gets brought out to do the takes and he gets zipped away again. I think this series is going to be different because we're filming during the summer holidays. Mm. So I think that he hasn't got to do any tutoring. So he'll be 15 as well. But I remember last time... He was coming in and it'd be like, what sort of music are you into? And he'd just sort of like discovered, like, he'd just been in the loft and found like all of his, you know, parents' albums and stuff. What are you into? And he's like, Blur and Pulp. And I was like, oh no, I'm so old. It's like, but it would be the same as you finding Beatles albums, Beatles, 12-inch Beatles records.
I discovered this band.
You won't have heard of them. I like cool music, Nick, like Pulp. And you're like, oh no, so old.
And what's your own personal uncle or nephew relationships, if you have any?
I don't have any nephews. Mm. I've got an uncle called Chris, who I love.
Yeah.
And uncle came out, and he's like an electrician. His claim to fame was being interviewed when the power went down up north in Evesham on Blue Peter by John Leslie, which... In 1988, it was prestigious.
That was big.
But now, you kind of think it's a bit tainted. So he doesn't really approve of my swearing or anything like that.
Right.
But I did this. Uncle came out and I got this letter from him, and I was like, "Oh right, what's this letter?" So I opened the letter, and it was like a letter. It was like I found these cuttings, and he'd gone out, and he hadn't just cut out from the newspaper. He'd gone to like the post office and photocopied the newspaper and cut out the photocopies of the papers. And so he'd gone to a lot of effort.
Yeah.
And they were bad reviews.
What?
They were just like, Uncle's a terrible show, and there's never been a more unlikable creation from Oliver Refson. And it was just like, you just like go, why? Why would you do that? Why would you go to that much effort to send me negative reviews? I think he just did it because my name was in print and he was overexcited and he didn't realise the context of it.
Should we play some music?
Yeah, sure. The next one is the John Dunbar theme from Dances with Wolves, which is my second Kevin Costner pick of the show. Dances with Wolves, the director's cut, at like 3 hours, 45 minutes. It zips by. I love it. I love it so much. I just think it's one of those films where it's sort of like the music is just emotionally stirring and the ending is just, it destroys me. You can see disaster on the horizon and there's nothing you can do about it, and it's quite a frustrating film, but I think it's amazing. And the theme tune, the John Dunbar theme tune, is one of the best pieces of music.
Talking uncle, then, do you, so you're going to do another series of that, do you have ambitions to do similar kind of work? Are you now turned onto TV in that sense?
I love acting. Yeah. I love acting on TV. I love doing stand-up comedy. I think if there's a world where you can kind of like plate spin and keep everything going at the same time, that's good. I made a short film last year, which... I directed and co-wrote, and that was based on a year in my life that happened about 10 years ago. Mm. To be honest, that's what I'd like to do.
And can you tell the listeners about your speech, the BAFTA speech?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, basically I made this little romantic... this romantic short film called Elephant that I wrote with my co-star from Uncle, Esther Smith. I had to do a speech. We got BAFTA nominated, ridiculously, because we made it for iPlayer.
Yes.
So yeah, most people are meant to watch it on their phones, and not only did we get BAFTA nominated, but we got invited to the BAFTAs, where we were in the same room as Steven Spielberg and George Miller and Leonardo DiCaprio and everything. And you're just like, that's ridiculous. It's crazy. And they said, what inspired you to do that? And I was like, and in the audience, it's kind of like lots of kind of like. Not elderly, but kind of like wizened older ladies they were, and they said why did you make your thing? And I was like saying, well, when you actually look at a lot of TV sitcoms, it's predominantly cunts being cunts to cunts watched by cunts, and. And I was so charming that I got away with it. And I, at the end of it, nobody really commented on the swearing. Except my mum was there, and she was just like saying, you did manage to say cunt four times in one sentence, Nick. And I was like, yeah, I know, I'm quite proud of that. I managed to get away with it
as
well.
She was very proud.
Yeah, she was very proud of me.
And so obviously with the awards and things like that, obviously comes fame. You talked about the kind of relationship with that. And you talked about obviously being recognised on the street in your hometown and someone shouting granddad
somebody shouted granddad at me and I felt really old, and then I realised that they meant uncle, and I was like, oh, that's all right.
Do you feel like it's something that you have to handle as such, or just that kind of comes in?
It's weird because it's sort of an ugly thing. Fame is an ugly thing because I think if you're pursuing it, then the work doesn't count, or the work is secondary. And I think fame should, in terms of how I feel about it, I think fame is a byproduct of doing something good. And you can either take that or you can leave it. And I think, fame can be useful at first because you can use it to get more jobs and you can use it to get more work. And if you're hot at the moment, then people want to work with you and stuff like that. But then fame eventually kind of goes away. And if you haven't got a body of work that supports that, it's a worthless pursuit, isn't it? Yeah, I think fame is a tricky thing.
I see when you're linked particularly to comedy, people expect you to...
be funny all the time. Yeah, or they just expect... In America, it's different. I think in America, if you've done a sitcom, people go, oh, there's that man from that sitcom. And now he's doing stand-up. He must be a good stand-up.
Yeah.
Whereas in England, people go, there's that man from that sitcom. Do the sitcom. And you're on stage and you're like going, I don't know what uncle... They come up and they go, well, it's not uncle, is it? And you go, well, I don't know what that is. I don't know what your idea of what that is. Am I meant to kind of like, what, do monologues from uncle? Or am I meant to bring a kid out and talk to him about puberty for an hour? It's just kind of like, I don't know what you think that is, but it's not this show.
Yeah. And your next piece?
Well, interestingly, when me and Ollie had that meeting at Baby Cow, we talked about our influences, and we both... because I read the script, Uncle could be an Adam Sandler film, it could be very broad, or it could be something that's a little bit more delicate.
Yeah.
And I very much wanted it to be erring on the side of... delicate, and so it was really important to work out what sort of what Ollie wanted to make before I said yes. And we both really love Wes Anderson.
Yeah,
I think he's come off the board a bit recently, but I think that my favourite film is one of my favourite films of all time is Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah, yes, and fantastic.
And I think the Luke Wilson suicide scene in that is kind of one of. I think it's a really powerful scene. It's a beautiful scene, in fact. And I don't think Elliot Smith is a particularly cool person to like, but I think Needle in the Hay by Elliot Smith for that sequence in the World Tenenbaums is one of the best bits of music in it. So yeah, I'm going to pick that.
Yeah,
and that is a film with a lot of good musical moments.
Yeah, it really is, and good tracksuits as well, isn't it?
Amazing tracksuits.
Great, let's have a listen.
Your hand on his arm, a stack charm around your neck, strung out and thin, calling some friend, trying to cash some check. He's acting dumb, that's what you've come to expect. Needle in the hay, needle in the hay, needle in the hay, needle in the hay. Down to toes, a reaction to you. You say you know what he did, but you idiot kid, you don't have a clue. Sometimes they just get caught in the eye, you're pulling him through. Needle in the hay, needle in the hay, needle in the hay.
Slightly more trivial question then. You've got an incredible husk to your voice when you perform sometimes, when you're singing.
Yeah.
Do you have to practice that? And how on earth do you not spend the year's voice. Performance money on just lozenges alone?
Yeah. I don't know. I've never had any singing lessons.
Did you cultivate the husk? Was it deliberate?
No, I think it's interesting. When I sing live, it comes out more.
Mm.
And it's... on the new album, there are some tracks where I'm singing quite nicely.
Yeah.
There are some songs that are very husky where I've kind of, like, gone full Lemmy.
So will you tour the album at all, or will you work it into your stand-up?
No, I think a lot of the stuff is kind of like been from previous shows. There's some new songs which I'd like to make into music videos and do stuff with that.
I mean, they must be incredibly fun to make, particularly with Uncle. You know, you get to make these fantastic...
Do you know what, actually? The music videos are the hardest thing in Uncle.
I can imagine.
They're absolutely... Because normally what happens is we have no rehearsal and half a day.
Yeah.
And... I don't know. I just they're really stressful. They're really hard. They're just really really hard.
What makes them hard?
Just because there's no time or money, and time is money. So if we had more of a budget, we'd have a day to film the music video. You basically need a day to film music videos, and we normally just do them in. Like, I know for the last series, in episode one, there was about like 5 music videos or 4 music videos in the first episode, and we did them all in an afternoon, and they were really short, because they weren't like full music videos, but they were still setups and concepts and costume changes, and lip syncing.
You know, you're rapping and
lip syncing is one of the hardest things because you're not singing, and you're not kind of like what you're doing. You're trying to recreate a performance that you did. But for instance, we did the No Survivors video, which was like a full length 5-minute video, and I think that's an amazing video. But we didn't have any budget for that. Yeah. I bought my own. I think I had 2 costumes. We rented one on budget, which was the Mad Max Future costume. But the pilot outfit I bought, so I had to rent that because we didn't have enough budget to do that. So that came out of my own pocket. But I said we needed 2 costumes. It couldn't just all be this futuristic thing. Yeah. So I ended up spending like 150 quid out of my own cash so that I could kind of, so that we could do the video properly.
Yeah.
And we did all of that in a scrapyard in Dorking in mid-November or late November, early December. It was absolutely freezing.
Oh.
It was, and we were out all day in this highly flammable kind of... there was highly flammable tar everywhere because it was leaking out of all the cars.
Oh, my God.
And it was just kind of like... It was just this... But it was such a... There's a mini behind-the-scenes video of it. It was actually a really fun, lovely day.
Yeah.
And it was almost like a reunion because we came back to do it after we'd finished filming Uncle. Right, so this is the new one for me. We're going to have... The theme from Suspiria by Goblin, which is it's a toss up between that and the sort of like nursery rhyme one from Profondo Rosso, Deep Red, which is Dario Argento, but yeah, I think the Suspiria one is more accessible as a piece of music. But
what do you like about it?
I've just suddenly got into Goblin and the band.
Yeah.
so I went to see me and Nat Metcalf again, but we went to see them in Camden. I tell you what, I went to see a couple of Halloweens ago. Alice Cooper did a talk at the BFI about the films that influenced his career.
Yeah,
and one of the films was Suspiria, and I had a massive gap in my knowledge. I'd never seen any Dario Argento, and I'd not seen Suspiria, but the clip they showed looked amazing. So I watched it, and I thought it was great. Yeah, and then the chance came up to see a screening of Deep Red with Goblin playing underneath the screen, and they played the score underneath the screen. Really? And that was one of the best cinema experiences I've ever had. And Deep Red is probably... I love Deep Red. I love it a lot. I probably prefer it slightly to Suspiria, but I do... But I love Suspiria. I love Inferno, which is sort of like the sequel to Suspiria.
Yeah.
I watched Inferno for the first time when I'd hurt my neck and I was on Tramadol.
Yeah.
And Inferno is like watching a dream, but when you're on Tramadol, it just takes it to the next level. So I recommend straining a muscle and getting yourself some of that. But yeah, I think Goblin are amazing, and this is maybe your gateway into listening to Dario Argento's soundtracks.
Let's give it a spin. So I'm sad to say we're nearing the end of your desert isolation disc experience. Obviously, I'm propelling you into the desert and probably a freak hang gliding experience.
Yeah.
How do you think you'd cope in the desert? You're a practical person?
No. I'd die.
Well, in the time that you think you'd be able to listen to the eight songs before that.
Yeah, that would be... Yeah. I mean, now the reality of it is kicking in. Yeah, I feel like it was...
I mean, I've got your ticket here.
I feel like I shouldn't have really filled my bag with eight records. I should have probably bought some water.
And we're very generous here on the podcast. We give you the complete Red Dwarf box set and the Tiger Who Came to Tea picture book.
Right, okay.
But you're allowed another luxury item. What would you like to take?
It'd be a brothel. No, it would be a brothel with a free bar. It would be like maybe a fully air conditioned home cinema. And then you could get with like a drinks machine as well at the front,
and some films,
and a complete library, or at least a connection to illegally downloadable YouTube clips.
That'd be fine. The cops can't get you out there.
No, I don't think so. They could, but it'd be a tedious, long journey. And then if they could get me, actually, bring it on, and then I could get home.
So what's the last song you got with?
Everything I Do It For You by Bryan Adams.
Yeah.
The third in my Kevin Costner trilogy. I didn't realise that I'd picked three Kevin Costner films, but there you go. I think I really love Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah.
And I haven't watched it in a long time, but I rewatched it when Alan Rickman died.
Mm.
I rewatched the director's cut, and yeah, it's great. I think it's really great. The director's cut is interesting because Kevin Costner went into the editing room.
Mm.
He locked the director, Kevin Reynolds, out, who was his best friend. And he went along and he cut like half an hour of Alan Rickman out.
Mm.
So the director's cut puts in kind of like half an hour of Alan Rickman back into the film.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about it was because it's the way it's reported is that it's largely an egotistical thing from Kevin Costner, that he couldn't stand the fact that Alan Rickman was upstaging him.
Yeah.
And so he went in and he cut out his part. But what's interesting about it, that might be the case, but what's interesting about it is actually he made a lot of good decisions because a lot of the scenes that he's cut out of Alan Rickman are quite unpleasant. And the way that it's left is he's actually a lot more likeable, and in actual fact he overshadows Kevin Costner slightly more. He's less of a villain and he's more of like a pantomime
he's not
guy that, you know, bad guy that you love to, the guy that you love to hate.
Well, I think we'll let Big Bri play us out. Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure. Some great choices.
Thank
fascinating
you.
Stories. I really appreciate you coming on to the podcast, and
absolutely.
And go and see you play live and go and buy your album. That's
yeah, nice come on the 14th of April to my gig. Mm-hmm. And my new album is called Nick Helm is Fucking Amazing, and it's good.
Right, over to you, Mr. Adams.
Look into my